FM and 101.1.
Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves. All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. I am not Maggie Dawn. My name is Liz Miles, and I am filling in for Maggie this afternoon with my friend and colleague, Aaron Hall, who's across the desk from me. Aaron, say hi, please.
Good afternoon, everyone.
All right, good afternoon. The snowy afternoon from downtown Waukesha. Happy spring, everybody. I'm not sure where this was in December. But here we are, kind of classic Wisconsin, late March into April, snowstorm. All right, so how did I get in this chair? Well, a few weeks ago, Maggie and I were having dinner. She is an attorney. I'm an attorney. We kind of run in some of the same circles and like to get together and hang out together. And she was talking to me about her show, and I was talking to her about some reading that I'd been doing recently about plea bargaining in the criminal justice system. And I was telling her it was real interesting to me because I was seeing criticisms of plea bargaining both from what I would consider kind of the left wing of the political spectrum, and then I was seeing criticisms of plea bargaining from what I would consider the more conservative right wing of the political spectrum. And some of those criticisms were the same, and some of them came from different places. And I thought that was really interesting to have one issue that both sides of the political spectrum had something to say about. And Maggie said, oh, my gosh, that's super interesting. I think that our listeners would be really interested in that. Why don't you come on the show and talk about it? So here I am. So I don't do any criminal law. I practice at a firm called Amundsen Davis. That's where Aaron is as well. I do strictly civil litigation. I do a lot of construction defect litigation. I do property disputes. I do commercial disputes. But that's why I have my colleague at Amundsen Davis, Aaron Hall, here with me. He does civil now as well, but in a former life, he was a prosecutor for Milwaukee County. So we're going to kind of split our time here and have a conversation about plea bargaining. Aaron's going to talk to you about some of the logistics of it and his experiences, and I'm going to talk to you about some of the reading that I've done and some of the pros and the cons that I've read. And then my hope is we can have a discussion about this in this hour. We welcome callers. I'd be very interested as we talk to hear from our listeners about their personal experiences. Were you a defendant who pled to something? How was that experience? We're going to talk a lot about, you know, one of the major criticisms of plea bargaining is the disparity between what you're offered as a plea and what might happen at trial is so great that people who are innocent or might have a good defense might feel coerced into taking a plea. I'd be interested to know if anybody felt that way or if people thought, heck yeah, I'm guilty and I'm glad to get it done. I'd be interested to hear from folks maybe who were victims of a crime and what your experience was like going through the criminal justice system and what your input was. Are you glad that you didn't have to testify at trial, or would you have wanted that opportunity? Maybe we've got some prosecutors or some defense attorneys out there that would like to weigh in. Maybe we have some judges, some former judges who would like to weigh in as well. So that's my hope. So if you have comments as we go through today, we'd love to hear from you. So I think what we're going to start with is I'll look to my colleague, Aaron. Aaron, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what you're doing now and then what your background was as a prosecutor?
Sure. So I also am primarily a commercial litigator at this point. I do some white collar criminal defense, but not the garden variety criminal defense people think of every day. I do a lot of trust and estates litigation, but all varieties of commercial litigation with my courtroom experience, I guess, from the DA's office. So
yeah,
which great. Is why I'm sitting here, I think.
That's correct. Yeah.
I out of law school and in law school, did nothing but criminal law. As soon as I graduated, I was sworn in as a DA the next day and in court that very next day. So, and I did that for almost 6 years. the last three of which doing nothing but sensitive crimes, which is typically crimes against women and children. So I've got a plethora of experience in plea bargaining and can add that insight from that
side. That's great. So I thought what we'd start with is, you know, I bet a lot of our listeners don't really even know what the process looks like. So maybe you could walk us through what's the process kind of from the investigation by the police officers, and then it gets brought to the prosecutors, and then just walk us through kind of the basic steps of what that criminal prosecution looks like up to trial.
Sure. So I think a big misnomer the general public has is that when the police arrest you, they're the ones who bring charges against you. That's not correct. What happens is, we'll say it's a burglary, okay? That means someone breaking into a house and stealing something or trying to steal something. The police investigate it. They find the person. They arrest the person. That could take, you know, days or weeks. They then interrogate the person, or try to, unless they assert the Miranda rights, and then they don't make a statement. At the end of that, they bring all the evidence they have into the DA's office, sit in front of me. I read all the police reports. If there's videos of it, nowadays there's a lot of squad cameras, a lot of body cam videos. So you watch that stuff, read the reports. Lots of times you'll want to bring in witnesses and victims to talk to them and hear what they have to say.
Even before there's a decision?
Yes, this is all that what I would call in the charging decision. Mm-hmm. You'll bring them in. I want to hear what the victim says. Sometimes you will bring the defendant down. Bring in witnesses if you want to. That's all at your disposal. There's no, you know, with a felony, you have up to 6 years to charge it. So there's no, the only pressing time constraint you have as a prosecutor is if the person is still in custody, you have a certain amount of days, a few days to make a decision, charge or not.
Is that something set by statute?
It is. Yeah, it is set by statute. The commissioner signs off on saying there's enough probable cause in a document the police find to hold them for, I think it's like 3 or 4 days.
Okay. And when you're looking at all the evidence, you're talking to folks, you're looking at the dash cam videos, and you're trying to decide what kind of crime they're going to be charged with, or if they're going to be charged with any crime, how do you know what kind of possible crime you're looking for, and what kind of standards are you applying?
So the police will, when they bring a case in, they have arrested them and booked them on a certain charge that they believe the person should be charged with. So take the burglary example. A burglary is a felony. Now, I could charge the felony if I think I can prove those elements based on what I've read, what the witnesses say, et cetera. But that doesn't mean I always should. There are other considerations. Is this a younger kid? Does he have a prior record? If not, rather than a burglary, I may charge a misdemeanor theft and a misdemeanor criminal entry to property, something like that, 2 misdemeanors as opposed to the felony. So there's a lot of considerations that go into play when you're deciding. You know, there's a lot of things I could potentially prove, but it also comes down to what I should prove.
So are there certain standards that, you know, if it's all prosecutors in Milwaukee County or all prosecutors in Waukesha County, are they all going to be kind of making the same charging decisions, or is there a variance there?
I mean, there's a human variance. I mean, to say there's not would be foolish. I mean, there is. But generally speaking, you know, all prosecutors, the one thing they want to do and what you're trained to do is do what's right and do justice. You don't have you shouldn't care about the outcome as long as it's just. So whether that means charging someone or not charging someone, some offices have guidelines as to what they do too. But generally speaking, I mean, most prosecutors, you know, want to do the right thing. And so, but there will be some just general human variance. I mean, someone may charge someone with 3 misdemeanors. I may charge them with 1 felony.
And is there a certain standard that you're looking at? Is it, you know, do I have probable cause? Is it something different than that?
So that's a good question. The ethical standard for prosecutors is I need to have probable cause that this person committed a crime. That's a lower burden of proof than what I would need to succeed at trial. That's beyond a reasonable doubt. So most prosecutors and most offices have a standard that don't charge it unless you think you can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. We have far too many cases to try to do otherwise. So, and that just charging off probable cause often may lead to more mistakes down the road. So I think most prosecutors think about how a case will play out in trial. Can I prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? If I can't, then I have no business charging.
All right. So we've gotten through the charging part. Say you've charged your guy or gal with a felony burglary, what happens next?
Well, it depends. If the person's in custody still, they will go through an initial appearance pretty quickly while they're in custody.
And what's an initial appearance?
At your initial appearance, the court commissioner, what the DA does after they get the police reports, they draft a document called a criminal complaint. And that details here's what I'm charging this defendant with. And then there's a sworn statement by a law enforcement officer that the DA usually dictates or drafts that says this is what I believe happened based on these facts. The court commissioner at an initial appearance, which is kind of a quasi-judicial position, they can rule on bail, do certain things that judges can, but not other things. They will decide based on, the DA will make a recommendation, should this person have cash bail, meaning they have to actually post bail to get out of jail while the case is pending, and other conditions of bail, such as no contact with the victim, no drinking, no drugs, if it's that type of offense. But they'll review that document and say, yes, this state's probable cause. The defendant will have an attorney appointed for him at that hearing no matter what. Even if they can't afford one, hire one. The public defender's office will represent them at that hearing. They can challenge the probable cause.
So what if the commissioner decides, nope, I don't think so?
That's very rare. If they do, the state can, I think they can ask that he or she be held for a period of time to reissue it. But it's very rare. I mean, if that happens, there was something wrong with charging it in the first place, frankly.
Yeah, fair enough. And I guess that's one of the checks that you have as
right.
well.
Yes, correct.
That it's not just the prosecutor deciding and going on, but then there's that next check.
And there's a second one after that, but I'm sure we'll get to in the process. So.
Okay, so we've gotten through the initial. What happens next?
If the person's charged with a felony, you have, in Wisconsin, a right to what we call a preliminary hearing. That's another level of protection. At the preliminary hearing, the state now actually, and this is within a certain period of time after the person's charged on a felony, the state actually has to present evidence, usually again to a court commissioner, not just on paper, which was the criminal complaint, now has to present evidence and testimony from which the court commissioner can say, yes, there's enough probable cause to bind this defendant over for trial and get them into the criminal system. So,
okay. And does that typically happen?
It does. It's more common to have a case dismissed at prelim than it is at on paper. Sometimes a prelim, I'll tell you, prelims change a lot. When I did prelims, we would call live witnesses.
I'll hold you right there, and we're going to continue this after a short break.
Excellent.
May the last one burn into flames.
Back. Thanks for joining us. You're here with Not Maggie Dawn, Liz Miles, and my friend and colleague, Aaron Hall. And right now we're just talking through the mechanics of kind of what's the journey for a defendant in the criminal justice system. And then we're going to get to a big, big part of it, which is plea bargaining. So where we left off before with Aaron was the preliminary hearing. All right, so let's keep rolling.
So just to go back to where we were at, the preliminary hearing is that the state has to put enough evidence on live testimony that satisfies the commissioner. There's enough evidence to hold the person over on a felony. And a misdemeanor, you don't have this step. You just go straight from the initial appearance to your regular court case. What I was saying when we broke is prelims have changed a lot. When I was a prosecutor, you had to put, if it was a case, say a sexual assault, I would have to put the victim on and testify at that hearing very quick. It's not a long hearing. There's not wide open cross-examination like there would be at trial. That changed by statute in the last, I think probably 8-10 years. Now the state can just present, they can present hearsay testimony. Basically the detective can say, I talked to this victim on this date and they said X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. But either way, it's useful because the commissioner gets to assess the credibility and the strength of the evidence, and the defense gets a chance to cross-examine. So assuming there is enough probable cause, there is a bind-over decision, that's the term, and the case then gets assigned to a circuit court judge for what we would call an initial appearance. That could be in a couple weeks, in a month.
Okay. And then what happens at the initial appearance?
The initial appearance is typically when the prosecutor and the defense attorney have probably their, not necessarily their first communication, but lots of times it is. And it's certainly the first time in which the prosecutor generally will give an offer letter to a defense attorney, and along with all the discovery in the case. And discovery, for people out there, is simply, discovery is all the information that the state utilized in reaching its decision to charge someone, good, bad, or indifferent.
So it'd be things like dash cam videos, police reports, maybe witness statements.
Yep.
Things like that.
Absolutely everything. And every DA office, as far as I'm aware, in the state has an absolute open file policy saying, here's our whole file, take it.
So you said that a written offer would be given. So is the written offer an offer to resolve for something less than what the charge was? Is that the kind of the first start of plea bargaining?
It is. It is. And it's not always written, but typically when we're talking about felonies, it is.
And why is that?
It's just, it lays out all the things, you know, you have to enter a plea to this, this, and this, and we'll recommend X, Y, Z. And here are the, if we're recommending probation, here are the conditions of probation. With misdemeanors, I mean, to go back, the difference in Wisconsin between misdemeanors and felonies, people throw those terms around quite a bit. A misdemeanor, the maximum time you can be in jail is 1 year, and that's jail. That's like your local Waukesha County Jail or Huber. A felony has the ability to send you to prison, a state correctional institution, for more than a year. So that's kind of the distinction between the two things. So lots of times in misdemeanor cases, you'll just give an oral recommendation. It's a disorderly conduct, you know, plead guilty to it. $500 fine, you spent a week in jail, we'll give you time served for jail, pay restitution, no drinking, you know, whatever. So,
all right. And so we've been talking about plea bargaining, but maybe we should define it a little bit for our listeners. So as I understand it, there's really three types of pleas. Plea number one is just an open plea. The defendant's going to plead guilty to what he or she was charged with, and that's it. And then for plea bargaining, I think we're typically talking about either a charge bargaining or a sentence bargaining, where in exchange for the defendant's guilty plea, either the charges would be dropped to maybe from a felony to a misdemeanor, a different type of charge that doesn't carry with it the same kind of penalties that the original charge does, or a reduced sentence bargaining. And correct me if I'm wrong here, where the prosecution would recommend maybe a lessened sentence in exchange for a guilty plea. Do I have those right?
That's correct. That's correct. It's infrequent that you would give a general, you know, plea guilty. I'm not going to make any recommend, or, you know, plea guilty. I'll argue whatever I want to argue. That I only utilize my own experiences in the most serious of cases, you know. Very serious repeat child sexual assaults or something. I'm not going to offer you anything. You know,
okay.
You want to plead to it so that the child doesn't have to come into court and testify, and the court will take that into consideration. So be it. But most of the time, if you're offering a plea bargain, it's usually a combination. It's usually, all right, I'll reduce your charge from a first degree intentional homicide to a second degree reckless homicide, which caps the maximum penalty the judge can sentence you to. But that's often coupled with, you know, defense attorneys, rightfully so, they will push for the prosecutor to make a specific recommendation. All right, this crime carries a maximum sentence of 25 years. I'm going to cap my recommendation. I'm only going to ask for 10 years. And then, you know, the judge can disregard it altogether. And we'll get to plea colloquies as kind of a, mm-hmm. as a way that judges can be certain that pleas are actually voluntary and not being done to avoid the risk necessarily, and, you know, having an innocent person plead guilty when they're really not, to avoid the risk of the heightened sentence.
Yeah. So I think probably most of our listeners understand that plea bargaining is something that happens. I'm not sure that our listeners know to what extent criminal cases are resolved by pleas. The last statistic I saw was that 97% of all criminal cases in the United States are resolved by a plea. Now, some of these might be open pleas, but the vast majority, and you're shaking your head, would be plea bargaining. 97%. I think that's probably higher than a lot of people think about, that only 3% of these cases are actually going to a trial. And what stood out to me was that, you know, it's not that plea bargaining is kind of part of our system. I mean, it is the system. That is how the vast majority of our criminal cases are resolved, is through plea bargaining. So I'll get now into kind of the history of it, and what piqued my interest with this is that I had started out by reading a book. It just came out a couple years ago, by an attorney named Dan Cannon. He is a civil rights lawyer out of Louisville, Kentucky, I believe. And he's also a professor. And his book is called Pleading Out: How Plea Bargaining Creates a Permanent Criminal Class. I thought it was super, super interesting. So Dan Cannon's, his focus is on the juxtaposition between labor and the criminal justice system. So he comes at this, and his pitch here is that plea bargaining was really created in the United States in the kind of mid-1800s as a way to keep the working class out of power by creating a criminal class, to get rid of the jury as kind of the voice of society, and that it really spread as a way for elites to keep the working class down. So if this appeals to any of our listeners, it's a super interesting book. I'm going to talk a little bit more through the history of it when we come back.
Robbing people with a six gun. I fought the law in the low one. I fought the law in the low one. I lost my boy and I lost my fun. I fought the law in the low one.
You've got.
It's the Maggie Don Show, and you've got Liz Miles and Aaron Hall filling in for Maggie today, and we are talking, at least in this first hour, about plea bargaining. All right, so Aaron Hall walked us through kind of the logistics of what the steps are in the criminal justice system. We had just started talking about plea bargaining, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of plea bargaining because it's something that I didn't know. So we just talked about how about 97% of all of our criminal cases are disposed of by plea and not a trial, but it wasn't always that way in the United States. So the first recognizable records of plea bargaining in America are from Boston in the 1830s. We don't really know too much about criminal cases before that because they didn't keep records like we do now, and the way that they worked were very, very different than the way they work now. But we do know, because we have case law about this, that plea bargaining was not only not common, it was discouraged by the courts. Up until really the late 1800s, there's a Wisconsin Supreme Court case from 1877 that addressed plea bargaining. So the language was kind of old. So, but this is what I got from it. So my understanding of the case was it was a lawsuit by an attorney against his client for unpaid fees. The attorney was hired to negotiate a plea deal.
Shocking.
Yeah, right. With the government's lawyers, but to do it outside of court so that his client would get a more lenient sentence if he pleaded guilty and testified against the other defendants. It doesn't sound so crazy, really. Apparently, the client didn't pay. The lawyer sued him, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court found this whole arrangement just absolutely distasteful. It said that plea bargaining was a direct sale of justice. Agreements like this were contrary to the public policy. So we could see even in 1877, in Wisconsin at least, courts were still looking at plea bargaining as it should not be done. So here's some statistics, though, about how this all changed that I found really interesting. And again, Dan Cannon, whose book Pleading Out is kind of what started my plea bargaining journey, has these in his book, and he focuses on Boston, Massachusetts. So in 1850 in Boston, guilty pleas were 50% of all criminal dispositions. Within 30 years, in 1880 in Boston, guilty pleas were 88% of all criminal dispositions. There's a huge jump in just 30 years. He says then it spread to the rest of New England and then to the rest of the country. And he gives an example, too, of federal guilty pleas. So this would be pleas by defendants who are charged with federal crimes in the federal system instead of state crimes. Federal guilty pleas in 1908 were 50%. By 1925, it was 90%. That's a huge jump in a really short amount of time. And now he says part of that is expanded federal law enforcement, particularly liquor and drug laws. At the time, there was just a lot more laws, and I think this happened in the states as well, that the criminal codes were getting expanded. There was a lot more laws to charge people with. And then also at the same time, you had a lot more people in the country. I mean, the 1800s was the same time that we were seeing a lot of immigration. So folks who are interested in Dan Cannon's idea that his idea is plea bargaining then, and I think the expanded criminal code was a way, he says, to keep the working class, which had been created because of the Industrial Revolution. Before that, there was really just kind of workers, you know, agricultural workers, and then the aristocratic class. And now suddenly you have a lot of people who are the working class and who are organizing, that charging them with crimes and kept them down by creating a working class, that plea bargaining then had the benefit not only of keeping those cases away from juries, away from our community members who might decide, I don't know, I feel like what they were doing was maybe okay, I think I'm going to acquit them, or even just seeing what's going on, for example, in some of the mills and some of the working conditions. And it was also a way, Dan Cannon says, for these individuals not just to become part of a criminal class, which then would hamper their social mobility because they've been labeled a criminal now, but they willingly entered that class. They voluntarily agreed to become a criminal. And so they can't get mad at the government for doing that to them. So super, super interesting idea. If folks are interested in labor movements and the criminal justice system, it's an easy read. It's an interesting read. I'd recommend it. At the same time, then, I read a book by a name that some of our listeners might know, Ralph Adam Fine. He was a circuit court judge in Milwaukee County for a long time, and then he was on the Court of Appeals for District 1, which is the Court of Appeals for Milwaukee County as well. It's called Escape of the Guilty. A trial judge speaks out against crime. And Judge Fine's take is really, he also is anti-plea bargaining, but he kind of comes at it from another side. His perspective is we shouldn't be plea bargaining because it sends a message that we're soft on crime, that we tell you that the penalties are going to be something, but then they're not. Then that affects the deterrence of crime. It encourages people, you know, your buddy does something and they plea it out, and instead of, you know, 5 years in jail, they get, I don't know, something minimal, and they're out, you know, out back talking to their friends. Oh, it's not such a big deal. So that's Judge Fine's perspective. He also has the perspective that it also eliminates the role of the community from having a voice in our criminal justice system if we don't have jury trials anymore. And it also keeps victims from being able to testify and to participate in the process. So there's some overlap there between what kind of two different sides of the spectrum here that I think about. So what I'd like to talk about now is some of the kind of pros and cons of plea bargaining that you hear. What are the criticisms of it? And I mentioned a couple of them, and I'm going to ask Aaron what his experience was and what his perspective was with some of this. And then, of course, what are some of the pros for it? I mean, we do it a lot. So I think, you know, a lot of people must think that it's either necessary or perhaps a good thing. But let's start with the thing that I think most people see as a big, big concern here, where if there's a big disparity between what you're being offered if you plead guilty and what might happen to you if you went to trial, that it may coerce innocent people to take a plea deal because the stakes are just too high. In an interesting statistic that I saw on this from the Innocent Project, was that 11? So the Innocent Project, it helps exonerate people who have been convicted of very serious crimes through DNA evidence. And what they found was that 11% of the people that have been exonerated voluntarily pleaded guilty, and that's how they ended up in prisons. 11% is a pretty high amount. So I'd be interested, Aaron, in your experience, and just whether you ever had a concern that there was a certain level of disparity at which point you started to get concerned that maybe the stakes were too high and maybe somebody who had a good defense might plead instead of pursuing a trial.
Well, I never personally had that concern because I handled myself as a prosecutor under a certain set of guidelines. I mean, there may be cases where I could charge someone with 30 felony counts of, you know, child sexual assault. I didn't do that. I charged someone with the exposure I wanted to get from them as far as a potential sentence. I could see that scenario arising where the deal is plead guilty to one of these counts, we'll recommend 3 years, or you can roll the dice and we'll try all 30.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't subscribe to that because that would be my fear in that situation.
But it could happen.
It could happen.
Yeah. It looks like we've got our first caller. We've got Tom from Grafton. Great to hear from you, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hi. From what I've seen, the justice system can be very, very cruel. And what I mean by that is that I've seen that there's a lot of overcharging. Like the charge of the first degree, when the actuality it should be like a third or maybe a fourth of misdemeanor, but because they don't want to take the time to go through the court stuff, they'll overcharge the defendant and force them, you know, to make a move.
So, Tom, what's your background? Where are you seeing this?
Well, I've seen it personally. To be overcharged really puts a person in a bind,
mm-hmm.
and what I was told is like, well, you know, we'll allow you to, you know, drop down to a third degree, and we're offering you this, but still, I'd be under the same rules, you know, for the rest of my life. So there'd be really no benefit to that. So it was better to not take the plea, but you know, the chance of winning in court is very small anyways, especially if you have a very aggressive, untruthful, cruel, a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you've got a personal experience of feeling that coercive effect, and that's something that people are very concerned about. And as Aaron was saying, I mean, overcharging, I think, is something that some prosecutor's office probably do.
Well, let's be clear about one thing. I wouldn't call it overcharging. I mean, if someone has committed 30 criminal acts, I'm well within my rights to charge them with 30 criminal acts. And if the pressure they feel because of the exposure they have, that's not of the DA's causing. That's the defendant's causing. But as a prosecutor, your only interest is doing what is right. That should be your guiding interest in doing justice in what is right. And what is right may not be convicting someone of 30 counts. And I, you know, you should not have a personal interest in trying to convict someone to win. That I never looked at my job as winning or losing. It was doing what's right. And if I got to a point in a case, and I've had this on sexual assault cases, where I started to think they're, you know, I may not be able to prove this case. There may be something wrong here. I dismissed it. You should never go forward to trial thinking otherwise. So, mm-hmm. you know, having that backdrop is what you should be instilled with as a prosecutor and can help ward off some of these concerns as far as plea bargaining, you know, essentially, you know, feeling like someone has no choice but to plea. Otherwise, the exposure is far too great.
Yeah. Tom, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your experience with us. I think one of the other things I want to talk about is, the idea of victim participation in the criminal process, because I've seen the arguments both ways, right? Plea bargaining allows for a certain and maybe faster resolution that doesn't require the victim to take the stand and testify and maybe relive some of those really traumatic moments. And then I've seen the opposite, where the victim feels like maybe the defendant was treated too leniently with the plea bargain. They didn't get a chance to say their piece. They would have really liked that opportunity. What's been your experience, Aaron? Did you see both of those? Does it just kind of depend on the person?
I've seen both of those, and I think that's an angle when people are talking about plea bargaining that I don't think gets enough attention, frankly. I mean, I will say, as far as Mr. Cannon's book, I've not read it, obviously, but I find it intellectually stimulating, but I don't find it very persuasive, frankly.
We'll come back to our discussion about victims.
Thank you.
We are back on the air, and I'm going to let my colleague Aaron finish his thought about victim participation in this process, and then we're going to talk to Dave and Madison.
Sounds good. So the point I was going to touch upon with the victims is you see it both ways, as you put it, and I'll put it in the context of sensitive crimes. So there are cases when I am negotiating a plea offer where I think there is overwhelming evidence, say, of a child sexual assault. I will give a large reduction in what I will recommend. I shouldn't say large, but a sizable reduction in what I will recommend if that particular defendant does not make the child come into an open courtroom. They're not closed courtrooms in Wisconsin. There could be 50 people in the gallery, lots of times from that child's family, and they have to look across the courtroom at a family member that did something to them repeatedly and tell me, stranger judge, 12 people in a jury box about the worst thing that's ever happened to them. To avoid that situation, because now at this point, I've talked to that victim. I see how they've reacted. I see how emotional they are. I see how it affects them. I will definitely take that into consideration. That is a benefit of plea bargaining. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, like you said, there are cases in which you have victims that are rightfully so. They're very emotionally involved with the case. You see that a lot of times, like in a home invasion, a burglary. People will want to send an 18-year-old kid to jail for 10 years. That's not how it's going to happen. I mean, as a practical matter, you can't do that. I have to take into consideration the defendant as well, his background, where he's come from, his lack of prior record, his circumstances in life, and again, try to do what's right. Weigh the need for protection in the public, but also weigh the defendant's place in life and how they got there as well. So you try to do that happy medium, and sometimes you're going to make the victim mad when you're plea bargaining, but you know, that's just a natural consequence. If you didn't have plea bargaining, you would have to have hundreds and hundreds of prosecutors, like in Milwaukee County alone,
yeah,
to try every case. It just would not, it's not feasible, and it doesn't do the defendants any good either. So,
all right. So let's talk to Dave in Madison. Dave, you're on the air with Liz and Aaron.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I'm not sure I agree or disagree with the practice of plea bargaining. Mm-hmm. But there are some real, real problems with it. You know, the prosecutors don't have to overcharge because our penalties for just about every crime, I mean, is draconian. You know, they're about seven times roughly, and of course, this is generalizing. It depends on the crime. About seven times what the other Western liberal democracies find necessary. Now, if you are a defendant and, you know, the odds, the penalty can be, you know, is a lot worse, often 10 times or more, the penalty you would get if you plea bargain, you know, it's very logical, and it might be a good idea even, given that there's a, what is it, 95%, 97% conviction rate, whatever it is, even if you're innocent, to plead to that. To plead to even a horrible crime. And also, you know, and when you do that, and sometimes people do that just because the logic kind of dictates that you should, that's being penalized for exercising a very, very important constitutional right, the right to due process.
And Dave,
you know, it also
go ahead. No, I don't disagree. I don't disagree with you. What I would say is the system is designed best we can to have checks and balances with that. The first is the prosecutor. So if you don't think that person did it, you shouldn't charge it. If there's any shred of a doubt, you shouldn't be charging that case. But in addition, as far as the disproportionate sentences, I think this is one of the issues I would take with Judge Fine's book as well, is there used to be a disproportionate, you know, you would get 20 years and only serve three. That changed around 2000 in Truth in Sentencing. So now if I'm recommending 3 years, that's what you're going to get, almost like 85% of it. So I don't disagree that defendants may feel that weight on them to plead, but the prosecutor is the first check, but the other is the judge. The judge enters into a long plea colloquy with these defendants on the record where the defense attorney doesn't talk, and is sure that this person really wants to do this. If there's any shred of a doubt, I've said it to defense attorneys and defendants, let's try it then. If he doesn't think he did it, I do not want him pleading guilty to something he doesn't think he did. Let's try it.
Yeah.
The judge will say the same thing. So I'm sorry, Dave, I cut you off. You can go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I don't want to cut you off.
No, I'm good.
You know, I don't see that many checks and balances in the system. Prosecutors, at least there's appearance. This is the appearance. And the prosecutors seem to have all the power. And a lot of it, given the high conviction rate, the difficulty of mounting an adequate defense, you know, like for a murder or a trial, you have to cost about $150,000, $200,000 to mount a viable defense even.
Dave, that's a good point. And that's a systemic problem we have in the criminal justice system, is that the prosecutors and more importantly, from your perspective, public defenders are not paid enough where you're getting high quality defense attorneys all the time. There are great public defenders, don't get me wrong, but there are not enough of them to try all the serious cases that are out there. That is a legislative problem that's beyond the scope of our discussion here today, but I don't disagree with that point.
Yeah. So I think we've just got a couple minutes left before our next break. Why don't we kind of close the loop on this, and let's talk about the judge's colloquy?
Colloquy.
Colloquy.
There you go.
Yeah. I don't do criminal law. I don't know. So explain to us what that is, and then I'd like to give just a little shout out to the judges that I've talked to about this.
Okay. So after you go through the process, I give an offer to a defense attorney. They review it with their client. The defense attorney also reviews at that point before they enter a plea. They have an ethical obligation that there's a basis in fact for the plea. If they think they have a very good defense, they should be bringing that up. After they review all the documents, bring any sort of motions they have, maybe, you know, probable cause, Fourth Amendment issues. But at the end of that, the defense attorneys, if there's an indication the defendant wants to plead guilty to an offer or otherwise, they will set it for what's called a projected guilty plea date. At that date, there is a constitutional form the defense attorney goes through with the defendant, goes through all their constitutional rights, everything they're waiving if they enter a plea of guilty and what that means, and also what the maximum possible penalties are. So the judge says, look, they go through this with the defendant, not with the defense attorney, on the record. And at the end of that, the judge says, I don't have to follow what the state's recommending. I can sentence you to the maximum possible under law. knowing all of this, you want to give up all these rights. You know, you can confront your accusers, every constitutional right you have. Is this something you want to do? And if they say yes, the judge will then turn to the defense attorney and put them on the spot and say, you've been through this with your client. Yes. Are you convinced that he's waiving this right truthfully, voluntarily, et cetera? And the defense attorney says yes. I mean, that's at the end of that, that's the best we can do.
All right. I think we are headed to break shortly. Maybe then we'll wrap up the conversation after that.